Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Hello, everybody. Thanks for joining us. Welcome to the Commonwealth Club and Week to Week, our news and political roundtable discussion program for Monday, June 10th. I'm glad you could join us. Welcome to everyone here in our room, everyone listening on our podcast, everyone at the NSA. I'm John Zipperer, your host for the day. As always in our program, we'll go over the important events of the last week or two, and any opinions we express, of course, are ours and ours alone, not necessarily those of the Commonwealth Club, its members or supporters. So let me introduce our panelists for today. I'm going to start at the far end of the stage. Melissa Griffin is a columnist for the San Francisco Examiner. She's a contributor to KPIX-TV and San Francisco Magazine, and she's an attorney. In the middle there is Dr. Larry Gersten, professor of political science at San Jose State University, a political analyst on NBC Bay Area, and author most recently of Not So Golden After All, The Rise and Fall of California. And right next to me is Deborah J. Saunders, a columnist with the San Francisco Chronicle and the token conservative blogger at sfgate.com. There are question cards spread throughout the chairs. Please write down and submit any questions you have. I'll try to work some of them into our discussion. And then later in the program, we'll actually focus on the questions and get to as many of them as we can fit in. And at the very end, we will bring up two folks to take our news quiz. The winner, as always, will receive a bottle of two-buck chuck. So, yes, we spare no expense. Let's start with, I guess, the biggest news story I've seen in a while, and that is the issue of government surveillance of journalists, of phone records, of computer records. And, Deborah, I want to start with you. You were at an event where the president addressed this. What do you make of that? What did he say, and what's your take on it?
Well, the president is clearly rattled by this story because some of you may have seen the story last week by Carla Marinucci in the Chronicle about how even Democrats are getting sick of President Obama coming to this area to raise money and not doing public events. So within 24 hours, the White House announced we're going to do this public event in San Jose on Obamacare. Now, this is the weirdest presidential event I've ever been to. They had a conference call the day before with the White House explaining what the event would be, and they said no press questions. And it was in a room smaller than this, and it was all media. And the president came up with five people. He never introduced them. He gave his statement on Obamacare, and then he said, oh, I'll take a question after they said they weren't going to. Jackie Combs from the New York Times asked him if he could assure the public that they didn't have all these files on people, and the president gave a longer answer than the whole event before then on that, and everything went crazy. And so, I mean, it just shows that they don't want to be preoccupied by this, but they are. And that was before this leaker came out, and that's, I mean, we know that there are going to be days of this to come. You know what bothers me? There are a lot of things that bother me about this story, but one of them is, where do we get these intelligence guys, these leakers? This guy, obviously he's a very principled and smart man, but he did go to China, to Hong Kong, because he said that they had a real history for speaking out there, right? And the guy who leaked the stuff to James Rosen worked is a consultant in security. And he called Rosen from his office line. And look at Bradley Manning. I mean, he's this kid. And so there's this all this, like, amazing top-secret stuff, and these are the folks who are handling it.
Yeah, you know, 1.5 million people have top-secret clearances. 1.5 million. I think we might be the only ones who don't. maybe some of you do. And it is astounding.
That's a great stat.
It's amazing, yeah. 4 million have clearances, but 1.5 have top secret. And you know, And of course, nowadays, we've got these various agencies that are kind of coordinating with each other in ways they never did before 2001, you know, 9/11. And the good news is, presumably this time he knows something sooner than he did before. Nobody's sort of jealously guarding their own secrets. The bad news is somebody who taps into one taps into all.
That's right.
So, you know, we've got a real problem here in on several levels, obviously. One is how do you manage all this stuff successfully? And I guess inevitably something comes out. And number two, then the question is, you know, just what are you supposed to do and what are you not? Where do you violate privacy? Where don't you? And that's the bigger question, I think, that people have to sort of grapple with.
Well, so what's your take on this?
Well, so far, the president's approval numbers have not changed very dramatically. What a recent Gallup poll taken between, I think it's January 4th and 6th, says that shows him down to 48% approval with 44% disapproval. It's not that different from, say, December, where he was at 50% approval. But I don't think that's necessarily an endorsement of what's happening here. I called my mother, who I consider like the finger on the pulse of the nation in Alabama, and I said, what do you make of all of this? I mean, it seems like it's just it's problem after problem. It's IRS problem. It's AP wiretapping. It's, you know, indicting this man, this Fox journalist, and now this Verizon, and now she said, look, we're probably going to freak out. Like there's a good freak out potential here, but we just still don't know yet what is going on. It's a damn mess, was the quote. But I think that there is this sort of snowball effect, and the edges become blurry, and we're all still waiting on additional information of how much information is being collected, how it's being used, who are they collecting the information from before we actually get there. But I think so far we're in this weird position where, you know, Obama gets up and he's sort of fumbling around. He's not really sure what to say. I think in future weeks, this is going, you know, once we get the contours of this, then there will probably be some serious political fallout from it.
It's interesting whenever you hear news reports about the FBI or other agencies who are tracking terrorist chatter, and you know, it's always kind of left to your imagination where that chatter comes from. And I think we get a bit of a sense of how they're able to actually do that, to find this chatter, to track it, to determine who's talking to whom. I mean, that's what some of this system, at least, like when I'm thinking particularly of this PRISM program, mm-hmm. And the Verizon, and frankly, I don't think there's any reason to assume that Verizon's the only carrier that this is happening to. And this kind of comes down to that, like you said, we'll have to see how more of this comes out, and we know more of it will come out. But it does kind of come down to the two-sided or double-edged sword, if you will. How much risk are we willing to take on the terrorism side by not doing this? And the other would be, of course, how much privacy are we willing to give up, or should we give up, in order to prevent the terrorist thing?
It's sort of so funny, you know. Days after the Boston Marathon, people were saying, "Why didn't you know more?"
But they did know more, and they just didn't do anything about it.
Or did they know enough? I mean, that's the way I heard it. Did they know enough to do anything about it? And now it's, well, now you're getting too much information. So, I mean, you can see how the public is, I think, somewhat divided. And to your point, I think most of these issues, I'm sorry, I think they're largely still inside the Beltway. Mm-hmm. I don't think they've really come out very much, like your mom, for example. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of stuff going on. These guys are always yakking at each other, you know. When does it penetrate? You know, I thought the one that might get legs would be the IRS issue, because everybody hates the IRS to begin with. So you got an audience of 300 million already pelting them, just on principle. Yeah. But even that one hasn't really taken off.
They must be thrilled. The IRS must be like, thank you, guy in Hong Kong, because you just took all the focus off of us for a minute.
Yeah, it is a big story. You know, let me just say, I'll play Dianne Feinstein for a second and defend the system. The more information they collect, the less personal it is in certain ways. And what they're looking for is who talked to this phone number, and they're not listening in on calls, and And I have to say, I want to have our security people doing it. The problem is I don't trust them. And one of the reasons I don't trust them, and I agree, Larry, I think this is the story that people are talking about the least, is the press. I mean, people don't care about the press corps having the feds basically try to snoop on the press corps. People don't like us. There are people in the Justice Department who have been for years anxious to go after reporters. They hate leakers. They want to go after them. But when you see stories like what happened with Eric Holder, where they go after the guy who leaked to James Rosen, and then they want to get the records on James Rosen when they know who leaked to James Rosen, and then they want to find out who was on the phone with his parents and their phone, that's when you start to stop to trust it. And when you see all these people, I mean, Snowden and Manning and these other people having access to all this information, it gets a little bit scary. So I think there's going to be a reckoning where people are going to at least look for more professionalism and more selectivity.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's probably realistic to assume that every power gets abused sooner or later by either or both parties. There were reports of the FBI abusing its expanded powers during the previous administration. There's the current IRS scandal, certainly has echoes of Nixonian IRS scandals. And we can't just kind of go around saying, well, I'm sympathetic to this administration, I'm sure they're fine. I'm really going to worry about it when the other people come into power. And Obama, on your blog, you quoted Obama addressing that, where he's saying, I welcome this debate, I think it's healthy for the democracy. I think it's a sign of maturity because probably 5 years ago, 6 years ago, we might not have been having this debate. And I think it's interesting that there are some folks on the left, but also some folks on the right, who are now worried about it, who weren't very worried about it when there was a Republican president.
Well, he's done a 180.
Yeah.
The president. He's done a 180. You know, this was the guy 5 or 6 years ago on the outside looking in, condemning very similar behavior in the Bush administration as overreaching, as intrusive, as violating privacy, you name it. And, you know, the fact of the matter is, he's outdone Bush. That's going some. And now the question is, you know, was that because, you know, he now sitting in that office sees the importance of what he didn't see before, or is he a person who's gone,
Well, I think the contours of the debate have changed as well since 2003. Mm-hmm. The Onion has this great segment, this great mm-hmm. video segment, and the title of it is CIA's Facebook Program Dramatically Cuts Agency Cost. And of course, the point is we disclose so much more now. Our electronic footprint is vastly, vastly, exponentially larger and more freely given today than it was even in 2003. So what might have, at the time FISA was initially passed, looked like a dramatic intrusion doesn't feel as weird, to many of us today who put whatever, you know, who are taking pictures of their dinner, I don't know, putting it on Facebook. What constitutes an invasion of privacy is, I think, a little different now than even just, 9 years ago, during the Bush administration. So I think the debate, even from when President Obama was sort of arguing this point, has somehow shifted.
We saw during the Boston, the aftermath of the bombing, literally people checking the Facebook posts and the Russian equivalent of Facebook, I forget the name of it, that the alleged bombers had been posting on. And it is kind of amazing in that story and others where you'll have someone commit a crime and actually go post it on their Facebook.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they're probably not going to be too worried about, the CIA listening in.
I do think, though, that there's some really important issues that we've got to grapple with that we sort of put to the side. This whole FISA stuff, Foreign Surveillance...
Intelligence
Act, yeah. Mm-hmm. Which, of course, sets up these judges who get requests for interdiction, for information. They've had, since 1979, 33,000 requests. 33,000. They've accepted every one but 11. What? 11 times they said no. Must have been a bathroom break. I don't understand.
What were those 11?
Okay. I'd like to know. I mean, so it is a rubber stamp. And I think that's where, among other things, and not the only place, that's where we really need to, are we doing this justice here? Is this just an absolute rubber stamping thing? You know, when the guy goes in, the attorney to the judge, there's nobody else on the other side and say no, you know, hold on. There's no defense attorney, so to speak. I think we need to shed a little light on this process.
By the way, James Rosen, two judges turned down before one judge signed it. So the question is, who are the nine?
The judge hung.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
So they can just keep shopping it to other judges until they find...
That's apparently what happened.
I wonder if that court... Say,
but yeah, I want to say, because I think Larry made one great point. I think...
Finally.
That's the second time I've said this, Larry. I think the president is worried about there being another terrorist attack.
Yeah.
And I think it was really easy for Democrats to take pot shots at Bush and hit him all and all that stuff, and now he's on the other side of it, and it's easy for Republicans to do it. I have sympathy for what they're trying to do. As I said, unfortunately, I've just seen them lying about too many things, and I'm not particularly trusting, especially this Department of Justice. But, you know, most of this stuff, they say that it stopped Najib al-Azazi, who was going to blow up the subway in New York. And what's the other? And what's the other one that was used? At any rate, I mean, they're trying to protect us, but they're not doing it in a transparent way. And I think that people hold Obama to a slightly higher standard now. They didn't used to. Because he promised that he would be more transparent.
But can they protect us in a transparent way? Think about that. Mm-hmm. Let me tell you about all the things we've stopped.
You know what,
okay?
Larry?
That's a problem in itself.
Let me tell you, this NSA leak is different from some of the other leaks. I'm angry about whoever leaked the story about the underwear bomber from Yemen, because it appears as though an asset or his family may have been compromised, and we don't want that to happen. There are a couple other leaks that are... And the reason why... Washington was so upset about the North Korea leak that was given to James Rosen is there's a belief that let people know that there was someone sharing intelligence who no longer is doing that. Those are the kind of leaks where you want to really be tough at going after the leaker. Doesn't mean that you have to follow the press, but it does mean that you want to do that. But this NSA story, my God, do you think that people in intelligence in other countries and that the terrorist operations didn't know they were doing this?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just watch the Sci-Fi Channel, right? I mean, this is something that is a policy that doesn't have a lot of the specifics, where I would put that in a different category.
Okay. Well, we'll revisit this during our Q&A time. Let's move on to kind of a 180, if you will. The grand old party, the Republican Party, has been going through some kind of a painful public reevaluation period after getting thumped in the midterms, or not the midterms, excuse me, the general election. Most recently, the party itself had a survey done of millennials, people, I guess, 20s and 30s. And one of the questions asked the millennial audience what terms they associated with the Republican Party. And this is released by the Republicans. These words were closed-minded, racist, rigid, old-fashioned, not very good. I mean,
and those were the good things.
Republican commentator and writer Margaret Hoover was at the club about a year and a half ago, and she's been on this topic, warning that her party is risking losing this entire generation. She says because. Either they're out of step with the party, or the party is totally out of step with millennials. She suggests finding, you know, some issues, economic opportunity or education reform, that they can find common ground with. What do you think? I mean, will are one or two off topics going to save them in 2014 or 16?
Well, I think a lot of that also was a function of the election. In Mitt Romney versus Barack Obama, I mean, I don't even need to say any more. Just picture that in your mind. In California, look at California, we don't have a single Republican in statewide office. And the legislature is overwhelmingly Democratic, both houses. It's in a way not really an issue here. There aren't any Republicans left to bash. But I think that it's just funny how things just flip over so quickly. And I think between what we're, I think that Rand Paul is somebody who's going to sort of be a Republican figure follow because he is appealing to kids because of his stand on the war on drugs, where Barack Obama is tougher in enforcement than George Bush was, and also I think some of this electronic privacy issues.
Melissa,
there have been a lot of comparisons between the Democrats in, say, 88 and where Republicans are now. But I think a critical difference is that it's not clear to me that Republicans think that Mitt Romney was their guy. And you're not going to change unless you think that your guy really blew it. And so if you can just say, oh, well, you know, how quickly did they just boot him into, you know, the backbench after he lost? And how, you know, quickly did he become a nobody? Because for a lot of Republicans, he didn't really embody their values anyway. They tried. This is their attempt at being moderate. I mean, you want to say, hey, Republicans, you need to be more moderate. They go, hey, Mitt Romney. Tommy Thompson, Scott Brown, the list goes on and on of moderates who ended up, losing their seats. So I don't think that the lesson has necessarily been learned yet. One of the great things about this report is that it talks about three things. It says, let's talk about like the social media aspect, we're going to talk about the policy aspect, and we're going to talk about the branding aspect. And they really focus on the policy aspect, because too many times if you go to a Republican convention or a group of Republicans who are meeting, they talk about how, oh, well, we got out-Facebooked, or we need a better slogan, you know, and it's like, no, the heart of the thing is the thing. And so what's great about this study, which to some degree is, you know, done by University of the Obvious, but there's nothing crazy remarkable in here that you didn't probably already know. But they do focus more on the policy issues that divide millennials and places where they actually maybe can align with the GOP. And I think that's a really big positive step, is to get away from the bells and whistles and say it wasn't the internet that's why you lost. You know, it is his actual belief system, and you need to think about that. And that's what's great about this. Having said that, I agree. I don't think that it's going to turn just yet. It can turn quickly, but probably not until 2016. It's going to take maybe another big presidential loss for the real kind of soul searching to happen. And again, I think partly that's because they didn't really view Mitt as embodying the Republican values of the party.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of truth to that. The Republicans will do very well in 2014. There's going to be a lower turnout, as there always is during off years. 40% of the House districts are gerrymandered exclusively for Republicans. 10% are for Democrats. The rest are fairly well put out for, you know, anybody. But you start with that kind of an edge, and you're going to win. They're going to win. And I think that's going to boost their confidence. We can take them, okay? And I think they're going to come out. Deborah, it'll be interesting to see what you think about this. I think they're going to come out with a real conservative candidate. Could be Rand Paul. You know, in 2016, and he'll get clobbered. He'll get clobbered, assuming he's in that same space.
I don't see him as being the nominee. I see him as maybe running mate.
Maybe what?
Running mate. Mm-hmm.
Christy Paul. Could be, okay, but I think, okay, yeah. Perhaps it's a nominee. But I think they'll come up with someone very conservative. Because the conservatives feel like they gave in this last time around, and had they had a better candidate, they might have won. So I think they're going to go tilt to the right where their heart is, and only after 2016, I think, do they really have this soul searching where they decide that they've got to, you know, move closer to the center. That's my take.
Hey, can we talk about the future of journalism next?
Sure, is there one?
Just joking. But John said Christy Paul, and I think I think people are going to look for. We tend to try to get somebody who's opposite of the last guy, and the candidate that the Republicans put forward will be very unlike Barack Obama, and very unlike Mitt Romney, and Chris Christie would be probably one of those people, but also. Yeah,
he'd be great. Do you think the Republican Party would nominate Chris Christie? I mean, he'd be fabulous.
You know, I heard the Republican Party wouldn't nominate John McCain. In 2008, they did, didn't they?
Yeah. Yeah.
He was my guy. I really liked him.
Yeah. In the In the United Kingdom, the Conservative Party, of course, is in power, but you could also say they're in somewhat of a crisis. They're in a power sharing with the Liberal Democrats. David Cameron, the Prime Minister, had brought them to the center on some issues, Liberal on other issues. But he's been tacking right lately because the United Kingdom, the UK Independence Party, has been stealing elections from them on the local basis. So my question really is, how much room do you think the GOP has to maneuver, more than, say, the Conservative Party in the UK because it's a two-party system, or should they just not do stupid stuff?
When I saw that press conference with David Cameron and Barack Obama, I wanted to be there and say, which one of you is more conservative? Mm. Because I think David Cameron and Barack Obama's policies are pretty close. I mean, your UKIP thing, yeah. And it's true that disaffected British voters are flocking to UKIP, but nobody knows why, other than that they're disaffected.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm not a predictor. I really suck at predicting, for one thing.
But that doesn't stop us.
If you hear me make predictions, it's just one of the great things about covering politics is that you don't know what's going to happen. I get surprised all the time. Who knows? Maybe Hillary Clinton will run for president.
If you think.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about one of Deborah's favorite people. That's U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder. I believe you've written that he's, what shall we call him, your least favorite of Obama's cabinet picks. He's certainly been in the hot seat lately over the spying on journalists, obviously all these internal surveillance issues. Deborah, are you warming up to him?
No, I mean, he was always going to be the worst choice. I mean, when you pick for your Attorney General the guy who was involved in the pardon of Mark Rich, a man who had, you know, gazillionaire who had fled U.S. indictment to go abroad, and a bunch of Puerto Rican terrorists who hadn't even asked for a pardon, you're basically looking for, and I think Jonathan Turley had this great column where he said Eric Holder is Barack Obama's sin eater. And our hatchet man, there are a lot of other things that you can do. But when you choose, and by the way, when he was up for his nomination, there were actually people who wrote that he'll probably be a better attorney general because of Mark Rich.
That it would have taught him a lesson?
That it taught him a lesson. It taught him he could get away with it. And by the way, under this attorney general, this president has only commuted one sentence. There are over 200,000 people in federal prison right now. It's really a travesty. The lesson he learned is that he's only going to push for commutations and pardons for people who give a lot of money to the president.
Yeah, I would expect, predicting again, mm-hmm. I would expect Holder to resign.
Really?
Yeah, I think so. Because, put aside whether you think he bears responsibility for all these things. The heat is just gathering, and somebody high up has to be the guy to go. It's not going to be Obama. Okay, there's talk of impeachment is ridiculous. You know, it's got to be someone in authority. And, you know, the buck, if it didn't stop at Holder's office, it sure went close to it.
He signed the documents to
So I mean, there's just a point where, you know, in order for Obama to, the problem is loyalty. It's loyalty. You know, they're friends. There's a deep kindred spirit thing here. And so at some point, Obama has to reach out and say, you know what, you got to go.
Well, you know, Holder has made it clear that he's not going to serve out the entire two terms. The only person in recent history to have done that is Janet Reno. And on the subject of Janet Reno, so Janet Reno, John Ashcroft, who else do we have? Alberto Gonzalez. I think that the attorney general is like the worst job.
John Mitchell.
Ever. You know, everyone hates you. Like, there's just no way to get out from under scandal and from being at this crux of national security and criminal law and politics, even though it's supposed to be an apolitical office. And Eric Holder is, he's a former prosecutor, and it's one thing to be a great prosecutor, and it's another thing to deal with a 100,000 person bureaucracy and to deal with all of the, you know, being at the eye of the storm. And it is to say that these maybe are two different skill sets, and certainly, you know, he's had a lot of what are called unforced errors, let's say that. And so their thought is that he will resign probably at the end of this year or early next year, because now we've got the new FBI director, we've got a new NSA director, we've got a new UN ambassador. And so sort of once all of these pieces can get into place and everybody can get confirmed and get the keys and here's the copier, then he will actually step aside and step down for the remainder of Obama's second administration.
What about the fact that he told Congress that he never had anything to do with any actions to snoop on a reporter?
Oh, yeah, I mean, definitely. Like I said, I'm not saying he's been a great attorney general. I mean, he actually, first he, I think he said everything we did was fine, and then he said, well, how we did it was kind of screwed up, and then he said, you know, like his story had changed a number of times with regard to this issue. So, I mean, there's no question that he has fumbled the ball on that. And I'm just saying that it looks like he's going to be, A, this is a very difficult job, and B, he's going to be leaving soon.
Yeah, but do you think he should be in legal jeopardy himself?
I'm not of the of that. I don't feel the need for vengeance. I just don't think he should be the attorney general. That's all. I mean, I don't think he committed perjury when he said that. Not in the legal sense of the word. But I do think that he deliberately misled Congress. And I think he has a history of doing that. And I just don't. He was a bad pick from the beginning. And when you're giving all this tremendous power to someone, and you want somebody who you can believe when they say something, and he just doesn't pass that test.
So, assuming he leaves not in handcuffs, he's going to be replaced by someone who's going to be pursuing the same policies, right? I mean, they're President Obama's person. Well, again, supposedly it's non-political, but really.
You know, we're assuming this linkage here, and I'm not so sure there's always that tight relationship. I mean, these people get into these offices, and they have responsibilities to carry out. I'm not so sure every one of them is taking orders from Barack Obama every day. You know, he's busy doing his thing as president. You know? So you take that job, and you mold yourself to it, and you carry it out, right or wrong, good or bad. The question is, who will he pick? Who will Obama pick instead? My guess is he's going to pick someone who is about as uncontroversial as possible, because it's been a real sore spot. It's been a real sore spot.
Well, the name that frequently gets floated is Kamala Harris, as you guys have probably heard before. So that certainly, it's generally when you have to think of, you know, who are the five most likely people to be appointed, she's usually on the short list. So we may have a local gal taking it over, which would be fun.
Interesting. Well, let's actually stay with you, Melissa, because I want to talk about something you've been following here on the state level, and that is voter registration, which might not be on a lot of people's radar, but we've got a problem, and you wrote about this recently in the Examiner. Can I ask you to give us some background on what the problem is? And how?
Well, actually, there are a number of bills being proposed in Sacramento to deal with voter-related laws. There's like a dozen of them. The Democrats are really enjoying this incredible supermajority. And one of the laws is to prevent political parties, or anyone really, from enlisting an army of clipboard holders to register a certain party on a per registration basis. So you cannot, the law would prohibit me from saying, here is, for every Republican registrant you bring me, every Republican, New Republican Party member, you bring me, I will give you $5. Because what has happened in the past is that when you do that, when you say, I'm only paying you for, again, my hypothetical, a Republican, then basically you get a bunch of Republicans, but you get people who are fraudulently induced into changing their party. They think they're signing one thing, they're not signing that, they're signing away their party affiliation. Fake. Just entirely fake registrations. And these are things that the clerks and the counties have to figure out, and they have basically come together and said, we're sick of it, we don't want stacks of crappy registrations anymore from these horrible, horrible consultants. And so what we'd like to do is say you can't base the payment on a particular party affiliation. And that is something that has been tried. Now, this is the third time. And so, you know, the hope is that it will actually get through this year because it's sufficiently curtailed. But that is one problem that at least that the legislature is trying to answer. The other issue that they're bringing up is allowing up to five lawful residents who are non-citizens to be poll workers, because apparently there are some issues with people having enough poll workers to translate for certain members of certain communities. So they say, you can't be like the precinct captain, but we're going to allow at least five of the rank and file to be non-citizens. So they can't vote, but they can be there in the polling place to assist. So these are two pieces of legislation that are up that look like they're going to pass.
You know, this is interesting. On the first one, party ID means less today than ever before, given the top two primary system. Why these guys are fussing about this, I'll never know. Doesn't matter who you sign up, because in the end, it's the top two who face off each other anyway. Can't these guys get serious about something?
And why aren't they prosecuting people? I mean, if people are putting in fraudulent registration forms, why aren't they prosecuting them? Why do they have to change the law?
Well, they are prosecuting them, and this particular group that caused such a fuss last year, for example, was dropped by the Republican Party, the Sacramento Republican Party, who had enlisted them, and the leader of that consulting group has been prosecuted. But what the clerks are saying is, look, it's so time-consuming, it is so resource-consuming to dig through all of these, you know, scribbledy stacks of things that come in the door, that it's better to stop incentivizing these people to be fraudulent. I mean, if you say, go get me 50 Republican, you know, Republicans, then, you know, you're disincentivizing the people with the clipboards to be like, okay, John Smith, Republican, 123 Main Street. You know, this isn't necessarily resulting in fraudulent votes being cast. It really just, it inflates the numbers of registered persons of a particular party in a particular place.
And then the other one is interesting too. This idea of allowing non-citizens to work in the polling places. Maybe the legislature ought to go back and decide how many polling places we need, since more than half the voters cast their votes by mail anyway. You walk into a polling place these days, and you know, a cemetery's got more people alive. I mean, you know, it's nutty. I mean, there's nobody there. You know, hello, hello, hello. And that whole thing needs to be looked at again, because, you know, we just don't vote the way we used to. And it's, sorry.
So my question is, why do we have private groups doing voter registration? Why can't that be? I mean, that's fundamental part of citizenship and government. Why shouldn't
they've tried to change they've tried to change those laws a number of times, but it's the courts overturn it.
Right.
And you know, the ACLU is against as you wrote is against changing this, because we keep talking about how the parties are getting weakened,
mm-hmm.
and people there is freedom of anyway. The courts are not going to let it happen. Why they keep reintroducing laws that don't do anything and get overturned? It's just, see, Larry and I were the old school.
So we're still going to have the clipboard holders greeting us outside Safeway.
They're
just going to be more disgruntled because they're not getting paid.
Well, the law actually allows for you to do that if you pay them salary. You can
Really?
I need Republicans, and here's a set amount of money I'm going to pay you for the week or for the day. It just can't be on a per-piece basis. And the idea is that is how it will be sustained, as not being an intrusion on First Amendment rights. But, you know, who knows? Try again.
Okay. Well, let's dig back into some of these topics we've talked about with some questions from the audience. Okay. This is a controversial statement I'm sure everyone will agree with. Washington is dysfunctional. Okay. So what are the circumstances that would restore functionality?
How much time do we have left?
20 seconds, go. Is that just something we live with? Is this more? I mean, the normal is kind of dysfunctional, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, Washington's a reflection of the country. It really is. I mean, in this country right now is very, very divided, and it has been divided for a long time. There are not very many people in the center. People are either on the far left or on the far right. And if you're in the center, you're you know, got a disease or something. And I think the people we send there, you know, it's not a perfect mirror image thing, but I think there's a lot of that happening. And there just has to be a point where people realize we're getting nothing done. And I don't know when that happens. And I don't know what event or events will trigger that change. I wish it did. But you know, this will not go on forever. I don't think this is a particularly right time in American politics, but I'm hopeful it will change.
I think at the very least we have to change the filibuster rule. I think that there doesn't seem to be any way forward as long as we're going to require. I mean, think about, I was reading an article the other day, and it was saying, you know, think of all the pieces of legislation that would not have passed. It had prior Congresses and Senates, technically, used this filibuster rule in the way that it has been. The Civil Rights Act did not have 60 votes, but it wasn't filibuster. You know, it's the kind of thing, if you look back on history, it would have prevented a lot of great legislation. I think that we can all agree now is good. And it's one of the main stopping points in Congress. Everything needs 60 votes to pass. It's a ridiculously high bar.
And yet the Senate Majority Leader, Harry Reid, seems very reluctant to, if you will, use the nuclear option that it's called.
Because?
Because he's an idiot. That's why. I'm sorry.
But no, seriously, what do you think?
He doesn't want to be on the other side.
He's never going to be on the other side.
He's
like
well
this.
Aware that the time may come, including 2014, where Republicans get a majority. And I think that's possible, by the way, in the Senate. In which case, you know, he's on the other side, and now, you know, right. But I do want to give credit to John Boehner for abandoning the Hastert rule, which I think
was
a source of obstructionism of sorts. And, you know, for the last several key votes, the Hastert rule says if a majority of Republicans, only if a majority of Republicans are going to vote for something, will we bring it to the House. Okay? We don't want to be the minority, even though we're the majority party. And on several of these key votes recently, he has said we're going to put it aside. And I think that is a really statesmanlike thing that he's done. I do. I give him a lot of credit for that.
What irritates me about people who, like when you call for the end of the filibuster, is we have people in office right now who just don't work together with or without a filibuster. And Barack Obama, I mean, when I've looked at people I've liked in the Senate, I look at, for example, the Gang of 14 that worked together to make sure that they would only filibuster the most outrageous nominees
for judges.
Yeah. And Barack Obama wasn't one of them. And Dianne Feinstein, who everybody considers to be a very strong moderate, wasn't one of them. And when you decide that you want to push for that kind of civil, you know, you want politicians to work together, it's always we're going to point to the Republicans who aren't doing it. Well, you need Democrats who aren't going to... You need to hold Democrats to that standard as well. I'm reading Olympia Snowe's book right now, and she talks about the overuse of the filibuster, and I happen to agree with it. But I can tell you that our president has been somebody who has a history for supporting this kind of move, and that's who this country elected to the White House twice. So it's not just one side. It's both sides. And I look at this president, and I feel that all he wants to do—the fact that he named Susan Rice, that he named his national security advisor—that's you know he's got a right to do it. I accept that, but it's like he wants the right to jump on him. That's all he knows how to do now: offend the right and whine about it. And that's what he does, instead of trying to work and get things done.
Or do you think he's just saying, they haven't given an inch for the previous 5 years, why should I?
Well, you know, and that's, I think that he is saying that. I think that's what children say.
Oh, Deborah, I have a little different take on this. Uh-huh. I think that Barack Obama was dead on arrival the day he took that office. In terms of the Republicans in Congress, and we've seen things, they control the Senate and the House.
They control. They had a majority of the House and a majority of the Senate for 2 years.
For two years.
So do not tell me that he was dead on arrival the moment he walked in when they controlled all three branch. They controlled the White House and Congress. For two years. You can't say that. How did they lose it? Because they lost elections because of what happened.
No, I think it gets more complicated than that. I think we get to the Health Care Act and all the energy that was went into that, and we can debate whether that was a good thing or a bad thing. And I think it also gets to the Republican minority in the Senate being strong enough, rightfully so, understandably so. I really think that he was never cut a break. And I'm not here to praise him or bury him or anything else. But I mean, there was such an attitude, and that Tea Party bunch, you know, was just, and there was a racist element here. And I'm sorry, you know, it wasn't good. It was poisoned from the get-go. I'm not about to put him on a pedestal and say he's done everything right. I can spend a lot of time telling you what he's done wrong. But I think there was a very poisoned environment that came out of that 2008 election, and I think it was, and I think a lot of it had to do with some really ugly traits of American character. I feel better.
Well, I mean, I'm glad you feel better. But the fact, Larry, is this is the modus operandi of this president. He never had a chance from the start. Oh yeah, 2 years. Well, that doesn't matter. There were some people who didn't like him who were racist. So we'll just. It's a victim. He's a professional victim. That's what he does. And he got. It just sort of astonishes me. He got reelected, being somebody who couldn't get anything done because everyone was against him.
Now I defend my friend Deborah here. Now she has the right to say this.
Thanks, Larry. I think.
Melissa, want to jump in?
I think he could have nominated, you know, Mitch McConnell to be NSA advisor, and it would still be a problem. Like, there's nothing you can do. Republicans are offended at everything he does. So just do what you want to do.
Well, aren't they
because it doesn't matter. They're just going to try and stall. They're just going to block your nomination. It doesn't matter who you nominate. So, he is enjoying or is kicking up a lot of dust with this, but it also seems like that he's never, ever given, it doesn't seem to be like there's ever anybody trying to meet him halfway or say, here's a better nominee for you, or here's somebody that we would be okay with.
Were the
it seems like anybody.
Were the Democrats better to George Bush?
That's not what we're talking about.
Here's one answer. Obama's judicial nominees have waited twice as many days to get confirmed, as Bush's did. Okay, twice as many days. We're talking hundreds of days. And meanwhile, the vacancies in the judiciary are just skyrocketing. That's a measuring stick. And again, I'm not trying to say Obama's done everything right. He hasn't. But I do think there is a basic obstructionist thing. We're going to get our chance.
So he has no responsibility for this atmosphere?
I didn't say that. Don't put me in that corner.
I would actually ask again, how much responsibility does Harry Reid have? I mean, he does have a lot of power as Senate Majority Leader, and whether it was using the nuclear option or something else, he is not pressing the levers he needs to get through. I mean, we've seen strong Senate Majority Leaders in the past who are able to knock heads or twist arms or whatever analogy we want to use.
Well, a lot of this gets back to the weakness of political parties.
Okay.
And by the way, I share your view on the filibuster. I'm not ready to get rid of the filibuster, even though I don't like it right now. But I think there are some things that have to stay constant, and you have to find a way around it. Or you're not governing well. But I mean, you know, the political party system now is much different than it used to be. Say what we want, and it's becoming democratized. The leaderships don't have nearly the power that they had in the days of, let's say, Lyndon Johnson, everybody's favorite majority leader, right? it's just different now. And so the Reeds and the Boehners have much less ability to do what they want to do compared to the days of the old speakers past and majority leaders past. Majority leaders have always been weaker than speakers, by the way, too.
Sure. Next topic. This is actually going back to our first topic of the surveillance of technology and phones and all that. This person refers to the statement of, if a citizenry sacrifices its freedom for the sake of security, it will have neither. So this just gets back to the issue of how much security versus privacy or freedom, if you want to put it in those terms, are we willing to have. I'm very sympathetic to what you said, Deborah, in that I think whatever your political views are, George Bush, you might disagree with him on a number of things. He did not want a terrorist attack to happen. You know, Barack Obama, assuming you don't think he's, foreign-born and trying to turn us into a socialist Muslim country or whatever. He doesn't want a terrorist attack to happen. But, you know, making that, my guess, and I'm going to throw this to all three of you, is that it's going to be a loud and bumpy ride as we get to figuring out what balance we want to have. I mean, we're in a world of some very interesting threats and as well as the technology that's affecting how we can deal with them.
Well, I think that, like I said before, once we understand the contours better, I mean, it is an important debate to have, and and each person's going to have it with themselves, and then en masse, you know, when we elect people. But we need to know what the proposal is. To what extent is this intrusion happening? To what extent are they gathering? Mm-hmm. How long are they keeping it? What are they doing with it? Versus a world where that's not happening. And in order to, I think, make that determination, we need to know what at least one of these things are. And like I said, it's a little different now than it has been in the past. But yeah, I think that's where we're going. But we've got to sort of, again, wrap our arms around it first.
Yeah, you know, and it's the kind of thing where technology is ahead of society. We have to catch up to technology. And it's always a problem. You know, go back to things like, you know, the radio or the automobile or the television. Any of these things, they sort of overwhelm society, you know, before we figure out what to do with that. How many mothers used to say, my kid's going to turn out to be a dumbhead because all he does is watch TV, right? Back mine said that. And right now with the social media and with the way we've used, you know, algorithms and all these things. I mean, it's so past most of us that we have to figure out a way to use it reasonably and not overuse it. But on the other hand, we don't want to open that door to let a terrorist attack happen.
Should that be handled legislatively or just through regulation? Or
I mean, part of the problem is that there's supposed to be congressional oversight, and mm-hmm. there are members of Congress who believe that they have not been told about what's going on. So. But you definitely need to have people trusting that what you're telling them is that they can trust you on it. And right. I think there's
Well, remember the key there is the Intelligence Committee. That's a joint committee of the House and the Senate. I forget how many people, and they are the keepers of information as much as anybody. And that we count on them for oversight. Now, whether that needs to be changed, I don't know.
Ron Wyden yes. says that they weren't that. He was angry that basically Congress voted on some key intelligence bills when only members of the Intelligence Committee knew about this NSA program and other things, and he believes that was a problem.
And Feinstein says that mm-hmm. she made sure everybody knew what was on the ballot, so to speak.
That's right. That's right.
Isn't that interesting?
I know. It's very interesting.
Yeah. Well, and they had a couple of hearings where they had, you know, people from
47 senators the other day at one.
They kept asking, so what is this program? How many people are you collecting from? And the intelligence agencies kept going, we don't know. And then there's a PowerPoint that's like, well, actually, if you look at this map, there's the green. You're like, wait. You didn't say that when you were, you know, mm-hmm. hauled before this committee. So at some point, you actually, in order for there to be congressional oversight, there actually has to be a free flow of information and a willingness to turn that over. And that goes back to your earlier point about the agencies and the silos and the communication that needs to actually happen.
So if there's stuff that is being done secretly, the hope is that having congressional oversight, some adults are in the room who know what's going on and could stop it. But if they're not being told what's going on,
and if you think Congress is adults, you know, I mean that.
Yeah,
and it gets back to we don't know what we don't know, right? And so since we don't know what we don't know, we're all kind of guessing, and that's not a way to deal with intelligence.
It's an unintelligent way to deal with intelligence. Well, and that echoes a number of questions here from someone, and their final question really is: isn't it naive to believe that government agencies, local, state, feds aren't going to screw up sometime?
They will. Anybody does. That's part of life. Take the best run corporation, there's a screw up. You know, screw ups happen. What you want to do is learn from them and not allow them to happen again. And to Deborah's point, you know, we've had several of these screw ups in the intelligence community in the last couple of years, and that's when you begin to really worry, you know, that it's becoming not an isolated incident, but more commonplace. Then you wonder, you know, how many holes in the dike do we have to plug? And how many are we not getting to?
And it's, why is there no process for review? I mean, you need to have outlets and you need to have avenues for people who are, who this information is used to target, to be able to have themselves, have their case heard. I mean, there needs to be that level, because we acknowledge, yes, we're human, and yes, we're going to screw this up at some point, so we need to, you know, allow for a certain level of review. And that's part of the reason why I think the security agency is a problem, as with the IRS. I mean, it's one of these, you get the bill, and what are you going to do? I mean, you're going to go hire an attorney for more than the bill is for, to fight your fight for you? I mean, it's one of the things about it that's so scary, is there, it's almost prohibitive, the kind of access to a review. And so when you're sort of consolidating this power in sort of one agency, you have to have the outlet. You have to create a level for people to come in and say, this is all wrong, you've got the wrong guy. And let me plead my case. And I think hopefully, as we go forward and we're grappling with this privacy versus freedom issue, that this sort of thing, to your point about the courts maybe being more transparent, is something that people have access to. We have to acknowledge that it's going to be screwed up.
Deborah, you're an everyday full-time journalist. Mm-hmm. Do you think you've been spied on ever?
I don't. But that's because I'm an incredibly naive person.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, I would expand that question then to, I mean, that's the journalist aspect of it. But to everyone now, yeah, I mean, any phone call you make, any email you send, whether or not it actually is being listened to or transcribed or something, the point is it can be. I mean, there's no technological leap that is required for, a company or the government to.
Do you think you've been spied on, John?
No, unfortunately. I'm not important enough.
My wife says, and she's like your mother with the pulse, right? Mm-hmm. She said, I don't know why everybody's getting worked up over this. I called Comcast about a problem, and they've got a satellite in there and know exactly where my TV is and how to fix it. You know?
What Comcast number is this?
and they do. You know, I mean, I don't know. You know, I think we do enough these days outing ourselves, right? Mm-hmm. With Facebook and tweets and
sexting
all and, these things. Yeah. I mean, we don't have to be spying. We're delivering the information. You know.
I don't.
Yeah, I don't know.
Anyway.
Have you been spied on?
I don't think so. I'm not interesting enough, I think, to warrant that. For that kind of resource.
If they're listening to me, they're so sick of hearing about my dog. So.
Yes, I think it is time we bring up a couple of contestants for our news quiz. So is there anyone who hasn't played our quiz yet who would like to come up and try their skills?
Don't do
to
it.
To win this valuable
Don't
prize.
Do it.
Two people. Raise your hand. This is your chance for glory.
There's one.
Come on up, please. Come on up. And then one other person.
You're not going to let him win by default. Okay, good.
Okay, please, sir, come on up.
Basically ignorant.
Join the group. You belong with us.
Come on over. And if you could stand there, and you're there. Your name is?
Kirby.
And your first name? Mike. Great. Let's take Kirby first. I'm going to ask you five questions. In fact, let me give you a microphone. So everyone can hear your answers. Is this working?
Hello?
Yes. So, five questions. Whoever gets the most right is the grand prize winner. And if we have a tie, we'll have tiebreakers. So, first question. Okay. This Friday, voters will select a new president in what country that was once described as part of the Axis of Evil? Want to take a guess?
Well, I don't think it's Syria.
No. Okay. The answer is Iran. This will be a successor to Mahmoud Ahmadinejad or something.
Yeah.
Okay, next question.
Oh.
Yeah, I'll stick with you for all five. At least five people have died as a result of a mass shooting at a college in what California city? Do you see the news on that?
Nope.
Want to take a guess? Also, it's in Southern California.
San Diego?
No, sorry. Santa Monica.
First letter.
Mm-hmm. Really?
You get half credit, get the sand part.
No.
I told you I was pretty ignorant.
Okay. How about this? According to leaked documents, who has authorized a target list for overseas cyber attacks? This was just in the news over the weekend.
Say it again.
This person has authorized a list of targets for cyber attacks overseas.
Not Eric Holder.
No, actually his boss, President Obama.
Okay.
Okay. Who said last week that, quote, nobody is listening to your calls, unquote?
I must not have been reading the right newspaper.
Want to take a guess? It was someone very high up.
Barack Obama.
You got it. Okay, so that what is that? Four. Let's do one more. Okay, following a court ruling in this other country, what major European country looks set to equalize gay and straight marriages?
England?
No, actually they did vote on it, or they are voting on it. Yeah.
That's the Lord's time.
Actually, this is Germany, where now the conservative government is now doing legislation to catch up with the court ruling. Okay, well, yeah, you got one right, so you're still in the game. Okay, Mike, your first question. Protesters in Taksim Square are demonstrating against what they claim is dictatorial rule by the president of what country?
Turkey.
That's right. Should I go on or should I just leave it a tie? That's okay. The leaders of what two related countries held their first talks in more than 2 years recently?
I don't know.
That was North and South Korea. Third question. Susan Rice, the new national security advisor, currently holds what job?
She's ambassador in the United Nations.
That's right. And you've won, but I'm going to ask the other two questions just for fun. Can you name the tennis player who just became the first man to win 8 titles at the French Open?
Nadal, is that his?
That's right. Wow. Okay, one more. Let's get a fun one. President Obama discussed cyber spying during a summit with the leader of what foreign country?
China. Year?
That's right, President Xi Jinping. Very good. You are the winner, Mike. Surprise. Thank you. And Kirby, thank you for playing. Thank you, everybody. Are you okay? Okay. Thank you, everybody, for showing up. We are going to be back here for our next week-to-week on, I believe it's Friday, July 26th. Please join us. And I want to thank our great panel, Melissa Griffin, Larry Gersten, and Deborah Saunders. Thank you, everybody. Please join us now in the library for some refreshments.